Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Warsaw, Bucharest.
Welcome to Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. I'm Nick Champeau in Paris. This week we take you on a trip to the virtual world, because there's a whole lot of things going on out there that are true, but that aren't real. I know it sounds confusing, but for real, it's true. We'll have a report about the 3D quality virtual world, Second Life, as a virtual Swedish embassy was inaugurated there this week.
Hereby I declare the Swedish Embassy, the Sweden House in Second Life, open.
Two ceremonies marked the event, a real one and a virtual one, and we'll have reports on both. We'll also look into the dangers of Second Life with a report from Germany, and we'll find out that in the Netherlands, virtual reality is used to help cure people who suffer from post-traumatic disorder.
Imagine yourself having a person sitting on a sofa looking at a big screen where he sees the 3D environment and walking around that virtual environment using a joystick. Another option is to give the person goggles or a virtual reality helmet, as we sometimes call it, where the image is projected in front of the eyes of the person, which gives an even more immersive feeling.
And we'll head to Paris to discuss online gambling. It doesn't take much to click on a computer screen, but it's real money that gamblers are winning or losing. All that and more in Network Europe. For starters, what is Second Life? Well, it's a world where you can make up a new identity, one where you can launch that business you always dreamed of, have the partner of your dreams, change the color of your hair, wear crazy clothes, buy property, anything you like on your computer in 3D quality. It was launched 4 years ago, and around 6 million people worldwide have already taken up residency in Second Life. They can do things that they're afraid of doing in real life, but what happens if they break the law, if they're dangerous? Because there are fears that this virtual world is becoming a haven for pedophiles and child pornographers. Deutsche Welle's Barbara Gruber has been investigating these claims.
Login was successful, and we're about to enter a new world. The window opens and we're in the middle of a green island filled with trees and flowers. The setting looks rather attractive. A few clicks of the mouse and we fly up to a huge hill right in front of us. There we meet another resident of Second Life, or Avatar. He's called Magnus Narcissus. He has brown hair and looks like mid-20s. We start to chat. Welcome to the virtual world of Second Life, a virtual universe where you can fulfill your fantasies. But criminologists believe that Second Life is mirroring the real world a little bit too closely. There's increasing concern that pedophiles are disguising themselves as child avatars in order to meet unsuspecting victims. Here in Germany, the public prosecutor's office is investigating such claims. But is virtual pedophilia or pornography an offense? After all, it's not happening in the real world. Dominik Stauber, a lawyer in Cologne, argues that it is.
In such a case, an offender can only be charged with distributing and acquiring child pornography. That means that the offender could get between 3 months and 5 years, because it's true, it's not child abuse in the real sense.
The American company that created Second Life is Linden Lab. It plans to introduce a system whereby users have to verify how old they are. But not everyone's convinced that this will be enough to prevent people from abusing this virtual world. Lutz Ulrich Besser, director for the Center for Psychotraumatology, works with abused children.
This gives offenders the opportunity to hide behind a virtual person. In a way, they're playing a game to prepare the way for real crimes.
But how concerned are the residents of Second Life that their make-believe lives are being infiltrated by criminal elements?
Das ist ein schreckliches Thema, muss sich damit auch beschäftigen.
It is a horrifying issue and has to be dealt with. It's not a bad thing that it's up for discussion, but the way the media is dealing with it is wrong. It's not as if Second Life is full of perverts.
Ich kriege davon nichts mit.
I haven't noticed anything, but then I don't spend time in those suspect places.
Es ist eigentlich zu erwarten gewesen, dass in Second Life...
Well, I think it was clear that sooner or later, sex and those sort of things would appear in Second Life, because it's part of every community. But I think it will take care of itself.
But the southern German state of Bavaria is not taking any chances. The authorities there have created a team of cybercops who are investigating Second Life in order to prevent and detect crime. But Peter Burkhardt from the state's Office of Criminal Investigation believes it's important to put things into perspective.
At this stage, given what we know, we can't say that this is a hotspot. You have to compare it with the Internet as a whole.
But cybercops like Peter Burkhardt point out that Second Life is an indication of how the boundaries between real and virtual life can be blurred. And media psychologist Gary Benter points out that users can become addicted to their online roles in three ways.
That virtual life is, let's say, a rich virtual environment. You find everything you would find also in real life. The second is what we call embodiment. It's much more than text chat. The third point is that despite this embodiment, there is the aspect of anonymity. You can play with identity, which gives you a lot of degrees of freedom. And I think all these three things together create a certain potential, let's say, for obsession.
He says it's difficult to say how much influence Second Life has, not least of all because the number of 6 million users is deceptive. Ben Schmitz, who lectures in media studies in Cologne, agrees.
Aktive User sind so ungefähr bei 1 Million Menschen weltweit.
There are about 1 million active users worldwide, 200,000 in Germany. But a lot of people log in just once and then drop out. More than 90%.
But Ben Schmitz thinks that ultimately Second Life as a social world will enrich the Internet. Psychologist Gary Benty agrees.
This is certainly a media world which is much more social than other media. So there is a very important component that also could be used as a basis for social learning.
After exploring Second Life and its virtual possibilities, we finally meet up with Robert Kremer, the real person behind Magnus Narcissus, the avatar who we met at the beginning of this report. And, what a surprise, the original resembles the fictional. So how does Robert think his virtual world will develop?
There's no doubt that this community will still grow significantly. And I'm sure we've no idea of what's still to come.
Second Life has shown that everything is possible. This virtual world could soon boast the world's biggest shopping mall, open 24 hours, and there are rumors that it could soon experience a civil war. Let's log out for now, but keep an eye on how Second Life will continue to imitate real life.
And thanks to Deutsche Welle's Barbara Gruber for that report on the dangers of Second Life. Let's stay in the virtual world for a while, but further north. On Wednesday, the much-heralded, long-awaited Swedish embassy opened in Second Life. The ceremony took place both in the real world at the Swedish Institute in central Stockholm and within Second Life. Radio Sweden's George Wood was at the real world press conference as Swedish Foreign Affairs Minister Carl Bildt cut the virtual ribbon.
Hereby I declare the Swedish Embassy, the Sweden House in Second Life, open. And we can enter.
Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt cutting the ribbon in Second Life while crouched over a laptop in front of a press conference here in Stockholm. The Second House of Sweden, as it's called, is a virtual copy of the Swedish Embassy in Washington. Inside there are exhibits of Swedish art, photos from all over this country, and even a display of traditional Swedish food. You can immerse yourself inside a giant globe of the world where every Swedish embassy is marked, click on the dot, and you go straight to that embassy's website. The Swedish embassy in Second Life was the idea of the head of the Swedish Institute, Ole Westberg.
The point of this is to disseminate information about Sweden to people in other countries, which is actually what we are entrusted to do in the Swedish Institute.
When did you come up with this idea?
Well, I came up with the idea after reading about Second Life in a newspaper just before Christmas, and we thought, well, this is a place where there are more than 6 million people. So we are active on places much smaller than that, so why not try to get out the message of Sweden also in Second Life?
Now, this isn't really an embassy, it's something else again. What is it really?
It's really an information office, I would say, an advanced information digital office where you can get whatever information on Sweden, from recipes of Swedish meatballs to about the atomic politic of Sweden or something like that. Whatever information you want to have, you can get it through this.
How much have you actually been in Second Life yourself?
Well, I'm there a couple of times a week, mostly actually to look in my mailbox, because you have a mailbox there. So I've been there quite a lot, but I'm not for a very long time, every time.
Are you planning on being there? Is there someone like you or other people inside the embassy to talk to people when they come?
Oh, yeah. We'll have hours where there will be people in the embassy who will be able to answer questions, yes.
I mean, what really is the difference between this and just having a really good website? Wouldn't that do the same thing?
We have a really good website, and this is a way to make traffic into that website.
Olav Esberg, head of the Swedish Institute. The Second House of Sweden is set on islands meant to look like the Stockholm archipelago. The project manager for the embassy, Stefan Gans, conducted a tour of the area and the building. And afterwards, I asked him about the philosophy behind the project.
Basically, we're using new technologies to reach new target groups. And also, we want to be doing this as soon as possible, because I do believe that in the future, virtual worlds will be ubiquitous. And so by being in so early, we get to learn all the, make all the mistakes that we need to make in order to be good at this when everybody else starts doing it.
I know when you make something in Second Life, you basically do it like one itsy-bitsy little building block at a time. The people who you worked with have reconstructed the entire, basically, the Swedish embassy in Washington. It must be mind-bogglingly difficult.
It's actually incredibly impressive to watch them work, because, I mean, it's very easy to make something in Second Life. It's very hard to make something very good in Second Life. They're absolute wizards. Electric Sheep, it's an American company. They're the best at this. And watching them was just pure pleasure. It is really like basically playing with Legos, but computerized Legos where you can change the shape of each bit, and it's a lot more complicated than that.
There was so much publicity when it was announced Sweden was going to have the first embassy in Second Life, and then you got beat out by the Maldives. How does that feel?
You know, I'm very glad, because I think it's such a good idea that there should be many more embassies out there. And we took our time. I mean, we took 3 months to build something that could impress. So I was kind of surprised. I was wondering where all the other embassies were. I'm very glad the Maldives are here, and I think there's going to be Macedonia soon, the Philippines, and the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, now you've got the building up and it's there. What's the next project down the road for this House of Sweden Second Life?
Well, this really is just the beginning. So now we have a platform. So now, starting now, every time that we at the Swedish Institute do something, have some kind of project, whether it's Linnaeus or whether it's Raoul Wallenberg or something, we have Second Life as an extra tool in our toolbox. So we have the web, we have books, films, radio, all these things that we can use, but now we also have Second Life. So in the future, everything that we do will have a component in Second Life.
Stefan Gans, project manager of the Swedish Embassy in Second Life, speaking to Radio Sweden's George Wood. What's interesting, actually, is that inside the virtual embassy, you can listen to Radio Sweden's daily broadcasts, the real radio program inside the embassy. In the Netherlands, virtual reality is used to train emergency services, either to prepare police officers or fire brigades deal with a crisis situation, or treat officers who suffer from post-traumatic disorder. Radio Netherlands' Marnie Chesterton has more.
You're listening to a major rescue incident. A chemical truck has crashed. People are injured. There's the risk of an explosion. Fortunately, this scary situation is part of a virtual world created by Martijn Bosman's company eSymbol from Delft in the Netherlands. They develop virtual worlds to train the emergency services.
Well, it's training for the
policemen, for the firemen, and for the ambulance officers and ambulance helpers that come onto an incident scene. It's both the people who arrive first, who have to take control, take charge of the situation, and the officers arriving about 20 minutes later, who are in charge of the incident until it's really finished.
Why on earth could virtual reality, looking at a computer, how could that possibly help in such an action-packed situation? How could that help prepare them?
Well, it sometimes surprises me, to be honest. But what I see during exercises is that the students, when they get into the virtual reality, they really start acting as they would in real life.
Yeah, I was going to ask about, I mean, how realistic can it be if you're sitting on a sofa or you can see your colleagues standing next door to you? Do people really get immersed in these things?
Well, yes, they do. They even get sweat on their backs. We've seen that happening. Firemen and policemen, they grab their radio and they start saying, get out of the way of that chemical truck, because it's about to explode. And the chemical truck, as you said, it's something on screen, and the policeman is standing 5 feet away.
Yeah, he wants to blast over. He wants to blast in the middle of a mensen and the west gun.
Can you describe the virtual reality setup that someone undergoing the treatment will go through?
Imagine yourself having a person sitting on a sofa looking at a big screen where he sees the 3D environment and walking around that virtual environment using a joystick. Another option is to give the person goggles or a virtual reality helmet, as we sometimes call it, where the image is projected in front of the eyes of the person, which gives an even more immersive feeling.
And what are the advantages of this kind of training? From a psychological point of view, how does this help?
Well, it helps because it provides them a safe training environment with a very complex and unsafe simulated situation. And safety in training is the basis for effectiveness.
There's a medical problem, post-traumatic stress disorder. The public have become increasingly aware of it, particularly amongst the emergency services. Have you got any examples of incidents where they've been affected?
If you look at the large disasters like New York, like London, like Madrid, there is proven to be a very significant amount of both rescue staff as well as civilians who are affected with PTSD. Virtual reality has proven to be a very effective tool to counter or to at least treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Research in the US has shown that a significant amount of people, rescue professionals as well as civilians, have been effectively treated after the World Trade Center disaster bombing by using virtual reality.
And how does virtual reality help with that?
The basic treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder is asking the person involved to think about actually visually bring back the memory. The virtual reality is used to immerse that person into the situation very carefully, step by step, starting with a simple situation where nothing really went wrong, until the point where they really have to more or less reenact what they went through.
So reenacting, but where they know they've got control of the situation?
Reenacting, but where they know that they are safe. Knowing that you are sitting in a sofa and that you have a trusted psychologist sitting next to you, that's the main point of the effectiveness.
Does that just mean you're downgrading the memory? For example, if you're reenacting a war environment by playing a war-type computer game, does that mean it works because you're changing your traumatic memory into nothing more than something from a computer game?
Now, what it does, it is enforces your memory. With virtual reality, a psychologist has full control over the visual environment. It doesn't mean that the person does not think for himself anymore, but it means in a lot of cases that those people who have difficulty in visualizing the situation are triggered to think back. Well, the technology is currently used by the fire service and the medical service and police services for training purposes. I really hope that these services will also start using it to do the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, but most preferably to use it as preparing against post-traumatic stress disorder. And a very important thing to achieve that is to have as many 3D environments available as they need, because incidents happen in the most unlikely places.
Martijn Bosman, founder of the Isambo company. He was speaking to Radio Netherlands' Marnie Chesterton. You're listening to a special edition of Network Europe on virtual reality. Now let's zoom in on online gambling. because placing a bet on the web is very easy. You don't even have to pick up the dice or flip a card. With just a few clicks of the mouse, you can win, or what's more likely, lose, a lot of money. The internet is bringing gambling into every living room, every school, every place of work. It's a 12 billion euro industry. The poker and slot machines are virtual, but the money lost and the damage are real, to the extent that compulsive betting on the net has caused people to lose their homes and families. In France, a new website, addictel.com, is helping people to overcome their addiction. RFI's Brent Grexton spoke to the people in charge.
Have you ever thought about placing an online bet on a football club or trying your luck at virtual poker? Before you get out your credit card and type "wanna bet" or "party gaming," you might want to click on another .com, Addictel. The site is based on a simple, powerful idea. Help people with gambling and other addictions to help each other by giving them a place to meet online. Addictel was created by Eric Bouana.
In France, you can play on more than 2,000 websites, casino online. You can gamble on 2,000 gambling sites. You see, then in 2008 or 9, maybe 4,000, 3 million people gambling online, and they do betting, they do casino, they do poker. But it's different because online is a cocktail of dependence. Okay, it's not only the gambling. As you can imagine, when you're online, you can be addicted only to the internet. Then if you add the money, the gambling, the loneliness, then it can be worse.
Bouana first launched the French version of Addictel as a hotline that lets gambling addicts limit or even block their credit card betting. He has found that gamblers on the internet are more likely to have a serious gambling problem than gamblers in a physical place. Addictel provides psychological counseling 24 hours a day, as well as group therapy and online chat sessions for addicts.
I hope people will be addicted to Addictel. So, because if they're addicted to Addictel, they will not lose their blood, not lose their soul, not lose their money, and they will have a real conversation with other people and with themselves. They will save themselves. Then, of course, if I can use this particularity of irony of the internet to save people, why not?
Based on his experience with compulsive gambling and the internet, Bouana is now trying to help all addicts by bringing them together for group therapy in online chat rooms.
If you go to addictel.com, you can register yourself and you can join Addictel if you are an addicted person for free. Yes, it's a free service. And if you are a relative to this person, you can also find help, because when a person is victim of an addiction, he's not the only victim. The children are the victim, the wife can be the victim, the father could be the victim, and those people have nobody to talk with. And with this system, everybody can talk with everybody 24/7. It's the only place in the world, addictel.com, where you can find people which have exactly the same problem of yours.
Taking risks might be part of human nature, but online gambling has upped the ante. Who can guess how many more people, hoping to win big, will become hooked? It's what you call a bad bet. Brent Gregston, Paris, RFI.
So, the World Wide Web can be dangerous, but would it be possible to live without it? In Poland, teenagers cannot imagine life without the web. After all, personal computers were almost commonplace when they were born. But does that mean that they're blasé? And what are the reasons why they go online? Krystyna Kolosowska of Polish Radio External Service went to a private high school in Warsaw to find out.
The average teenager's approach to the net tends to be practical. Virtual reality is not an escape from real-life problems. They need it to talk to friends, do homework, listen to the music. It may be a second home, but not to the point of losing contact with the reality. As I found out talking to Eva, Ola, Rafał, Maciek and Makary, teenagers from a Warsaw high school. But first of all, can they imagine life without computers?
It's very addictive. It's like mobiles now. So I would feel like without a hand. It's hard to imagine to live without computers or some electronic devices.
Yeah, so I think that it would be hard because of the internet.
and we would lose the connection with the whole world, very fast connection. And it would be also hard with writing some things because we are not used to write with our hands, and younger, especially young people.
Do you chat often on the internet, for example?
I think we mostly use the ICQ type communicators. We don't chat like this, don't use those like group chats where thousands and more people chat all together in the same time. We use rather the communicators when you specify the amount of people you want to speak to, and you speak to the people you want to speak to.
Do you read blogs?
No, I don't. Because it's not interesting for me to read someone's story, someone's life, and it's very common for people to write in blogs their own problems, their own stories, and I think that it's not the best way to share your feelings in the internet.
Have you often come across unpleasant things on the web, like inciting to violence or anything, porn?
In the internet, people can be on the net while they are chatting with others. They can be any kind they really wanted to, so they become more like encouraged to do things that they are not doing when they are talking face to face. They're more aggressive. And
specialists say that one can actually get addicted to computers, to computer games, to web surfing. Do you think that it's a real danger?
Yeah, because internet and computers are really addictive, because thanks to them you don't need real life, because you've got everything there. You can meet your friends, you can make new friendships, if I can say like that, and people start to create their own world only with the computers and internet, and they don't need the reality any longer.
I was talking to Eva, Ola, Rafał, Maciek and Makary, teenagers from Warsaw High School. For Network Europe, I'm Krystyna Kołosowska.
And I'm afraid that's all we have time for on this edition of Network Europe. From me, Nick Szampo, it's goodbye and thanks for joining us. And thanks to studio producer Joanna Labetz and sound engineer Cyril Etienne. If we've tempted you to go surfing on the World Wide Web, well, why not visit our website? It's www.networkeurope.org. You can check out our archives or subscribe to our podcasts on the site. We'll leave you with music, which I found on MySpace. MySpace is a website where tens of millions of web community members meet to share their taste for music, film, literature, contemporary art. The list goes on. And it's very popular among bands because instead of going through the costly process of cutting a record, they just put their new tracks on the site, hoping that the web community will react positively and ultimately convince music labels to sign them. Probably what this new band is hoping for. They're from Brussels. They've mixed their album in Barcelona with an English producer, and they joined the MySpace community this week. Their name is Café Neon. They're coming to Paris, actually, in a couple of days' time, so maybe I'm going to have an opportunity to chat with them for real. But if you want to listen to their tracks and find out more about them, the address is www.myspace.com/Café Neon. In the meantime, here's an extract of their LP. It's called Orange. Have a real good weekend. Café Neon coming your way. Bye-bye.
Curieuse. Après les rêves, parle-moi de toi.